This is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. More heat in the matter of global warming. Former Vice President Al Gore says ExxonMobil and other large energy companies are funding misinformation campaigns. Gore says they're spending $10 million a year in a concerted effort to convince the public that there is a disagreement in the scientific community about global warming. ExxonMobil has denied Al Gore's charges. Gore has been raising concerns about global warming for decades, and he says American politicians have only been taking baby steps in addressing it. Gore laid out some of his concerns and frustrations in a mid-July appearance at the Aspen Institute, and it's that conversation we'll hear this hour on Word for Word. While Al Gore laments that Congress isn't doing more about the issue he holds dear, his Oscar-winning documentary, An Inconvenient Truth, has put the matter more in the public eye. And this summer, the one-time Democratic presidential candidate launched the Live Earth Concert, a 24-hour series of music concerts held around the world to raise awareness about global warming. Gore is also out with a new book, The Assault on Reason. It's a critique of the administration of George Bush, whom Gore surpassed in the popular vote in the 2000 presidential race. Al Gore spoke at the Green Tech Innovation Network Summit in Aspen on July 18th. It was a session moderated by venture capitalist John Doerr, who asked about the Live Earth effort.
Did you succeed in Live Earth with what you set out to accomplish?
Live Earth was intended to be the launch of a three to five year a global campaign to move this country and the world past a political tipping point beyond which public opinion is so transformed on the climate crisis that political, business, and civic leaders in every country will compete to offer genuinely effective solutions for the climate crisis. And I think that it did succeed in that goal in launching that campaign. We had tremendous feedback all around the world, and it tripled the previous record for online viewing. It was broadcast both on television and radio everywhere in the world, and a lot more to come. There's a lot of spin-off activity out of it, but it's all aimed at it. There was never any idea that it would be an end in itself, but really it was just intended to launch this movement, and I think that it did succeed in that goal.
I was struck by a call to action. I think it was a 7-point pledge.
Right.
And the first point of that pledge talked about reducing something by 90%, which struck
right.
me as really outrageous. What is that pledge?
Well,
and
you know,
how did you choose that?
Yeah, the concert took place on 7707, so we decided the pledge ought to be a 7-point pledge. And so I parsed it all down into 7 points and consulted widely, not only here in the U.S., but in other countries, in the formulation of that pledge. And the first point, as you say, is I pledge to demand that my country join a global treaty within 2 years that will require that will reduce CO2 emissions by 90% in developed countries and by more than half worldwide in time for the next generation to inherit a healthy Earth. In order to have sharp global reductions in CO2 in time to avoid catastrophe, there have to be much larger reductions on a percentage basis in the developed countries that have been largely responsible for creating the problem, though there also have to be sharp reductions in other countries as well.
90%.
Yeah.
What would that mean for you, for me? For
well, if somebody had asked in 1900 whether or not it was possible to have in New York City to have a 90% reduction in the horse manure problem that the city had at that time, it might have sounded impossible. But the introduction of what was then a superior technology, the horseless carriage, made it pretty easy to achieve that goal. And I think that the entire global economy, particularly in the developed countries, is poised to move to a more granular level where both carbon dioxide and electrons are kept track of with much greater precision, in the same way that bits of information are kept track of much more efficiently and accurately now than they were 10 years ago. You know, when I became vice president, there were only 4 dozen sites on the World Wide Web.
There was really no internet, right? No web browser.
The web was introduced just that year, and I remember going on the Today Show with Katie Couric and say, "Well, this is called the World Wide Web." But my point is that within 10 years there were billions of sites, and the cost reduction curve and the efficiency improvements that came from using the new capacities we have with high-performance computers and the networked solutions that the internet made possible led to those dramatic changes and a distributed information processing universe. We can do the same thing with energy, with conservation, with efficiency, with new designs, and we really have to. We are facing a true planetary emergency. And if there's one message that I want to leave with to make sure that I get across is what we're facing worldwide really is a planetary emergency. It's without any precedent. It's difficult to realize and to absorb because there's nothing in our previous history that prepares us for it. But it's based in a radical redefinition of the relationship between the human species and our planet. And there are 3 factors that have combined. We have quadrupled population in less than 100 years. And although that part of the problem is stabilizing of its own accord, we've figured out over the last 20 years worldwide what actually works to facilitate the stabilizing of population. And it's not population control or anything of the sort. It's education of girls, empowerment of women, availability of family planning techniques that are culturally acceptable, and higher child survival rates. You put those 4 things in place, particularly the education of girls and women's literacy. You put that in place, then it happens. You get a lower average family size. But the transformed relationship between humans and the earth is driven, first of all, by that huge increase in population. The other two quickly?
Yeah.
Or do you want me to?
No, go.
The technology revolution is even more important, far more important, because it has magnified by many thousands of times the average power, leveraging power we have to have an impact on the environment in indulging age-old human habits. And then third, our way
what's
of...
What's a good example of that?
Well, to take an example, well, the air in this tent has 6 times as many chlorine atoms in each lungful than it did 40 years ago. And that's true at the North Pole, the South Pole, and everywhere because of only one family of relatively unimportant technologies, the chlorofluorocarbons and associated chemicals that were used for refrigeration, cleaning circuit boards, lots of other things. Yeah. They first invented in the 1930s in the interwar period, first produced in volume in the 1950s. In a single generation, that they transformed sixfold the concentration of chlorine atoms in the entire Earth's atmosphere. And we weren't even aware of it. Now, that doesn't directly hurt human health, but it is the cause of the stratospheric ozone problem. In a much larger and more important way, we have mechanized the process of turning fossil fuels into carbon dioxide, and we now have a global carbon crisis that is driven partly by population, partly by technology, and partly by our way of thinking, which is characterized by a dangerous degree of obliviousness to it and systems for making choices in the political and economic spheres that do not give us accurate readings on the full cost and consequences of the choices we're making.
Okay, so let's go back to Live Earth for just a moment.
Okay.
If individuals want to do something about this, should they go somewhere to take this pledge? What do you want?
LiveEarth.org, you go to AlGore.com, take the pledge, become carbon neutral. It's actually not that difficult to reduce. And, you know, there's a whole philosophical debate about offsets. I think that the debate properly is on the kinds of offsets. But the combination can, everybody can get carbon neutral. You ought to protect forests, plant trees, make intelligent choices as a consumer and as a citizen. support leaders and businesses that share your commitment to solving the climate crisis.
Okay, let's go to the Academy Award-winning Inconvenient Truth. Were you surprised by its success? And what have you learned since then? That's really important.
Well, I'd like to be able to say that I wasn't surprised at all, but I knew so little. I actually thought it was a bad idea to make a movie out of
the
slideshow. But
it worked.
It did work, and I'm glad that the producers and the director, Davis Guggenheim, talked some sense into me about it. And I mean, it wasn't that difficult. They sort of pointed out that it is possible to take a live stage performance and turn it into a movie, and I think they did a great job. And it's made a big difference in the ability to. I mean, I've been trying to tell this story for 30 years, and that slideshow and book and movie made a huge difference. And I give Tipper credit for it, by the way, because I had been showing Kodak slides for a long time, and after I left my job in the White House, she said, "Oh, by the way, Mr. Information Superhighway, we have computers in the 21st century, and you should put these on computer." It made a big difference in my ability to communicate with more people more effectively.
Yeah. Since that movie, are we winning or losing? Are you more concerned?
Oh, I'm much more concerned. I'm optimistic, and I'll tell you why. But there should be no illusion about the fact that we are losing this battle badly. If you put the crisis at one end of a football field and human civilization at the other end, we're fighting between our 2 and 3 yard line right now, and the crisis is winning.
We got to get to the other end.
Yeah, but the political system of our world and our country shares one thing in common with the climate system. It is nonlinear. The very slow pace of change that we get used to is not the only kind of change that's possible. Once there is a critical mass of thinking, once there's a critical mass of opinion and people realize what the truth of our situation is, Then I know from previous experience that we can move past a tipping point, and the political system can move very, very quickly. In 1941, it would have been considered absurd for the United States to manufacture 1,000 airplanes. But by 1944, that was really a small number. And the wartime metaphor is sometimes overused, but We face, for the first time in the history of the human species, the possibility of a complete of a threat that could lead to the complete collapse of human civilization.
The complete collapse.
Complete collapse. Absolutely, and shockingly, the best scientists in the world, the ones I trust the most, have started just in the last year or so saying that we may have as little as 10 years within which to bring about a major start to the significant changes that are necessary. And we cannot afford to piddle around with this problem and have these pointless, insulting arguments about whether it's real or not. One of the scientific publications that I read on the web, realclimate.org, reported a study a few days ago completely destroying one of the skeptics' things that it's the sun, you know, and it's that actually the fact that we're putting 70 million tons of CO2 into the Earth's atmosphere every day as if it was an open sewer has no consequences at all. But somebody described it as putting the nail in the coffin of that argument, and one of the other scientists wrote in and said, no, actually the hard part is this. There are so many nails in that coffin, it's hard to find an open place to put another nail in the coffin. But yet, because the truth really is inconvenient to a greater or lesser degree for all of us, but to a greater degree for the large carbon polluters who have an outsized influence on the formulation of political policy in this country and around the world, there is still this rearguard action trying to deny the truth and to slow down the formation of this political consensus that's based on truth. I was mentioning to a smaller group this morning, M. Scott Peck, who many of you know as the author of that legendary book, The Road Less Traveled, had a very interesting definition of evil. Evil, Peck said, is absence of truth. And the first time I read that, I thought, I don't know. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought it's really, really profound. And when we, you know, we all try to live by the saying that you shall know the truth and the truth shall set you free. We have to find a way to acknowledge the truth of our situation. We are living in a very thin biosphere surrounding our planet, and the composition of the atmosphere has been relatively unchanged for at least a million, probably 35 million years. And just in the last 100 years, we have begun to radically transform it to a point that where it is, we have actually changed the heat balance between the Earth and the Sun. And if we continue without stopping this, if we don't stop it pretty quickly, temperatures will rise far above any levels that the human species has ever known and destroy and threaten to destroy, not the planet. The planet will be fine, but it's the habitability of the planet for us as human beings that is very much at risk unless we change this pattern very quickly.
Al, you wrote an opinion in the New York Times just at the start of the month which said, this is not a political issue, this is a moral issue. And you also said that it's an opportunity for a generational mission.
Yeah.
You told a story of two planets. Tell us.
Yeah. Or here's a brief tale of two planets, if you will. Earth and Venus. Earth and Venus are almost exactly the same size. The difference in the diameter is less than 400 miles. Earth and Venus have almost exactly the same amount of carbon. The difference is that most of the carbon here on Earth is in the ground, and it was put there over the last 600 million years by life. Various multicellular forms of life on Earth have scavenged carbon and through metabolism and death sequestered it deep into the ground. Most of the carbon on Venus, by contrast, is in the atmosphere of Venus. Now, for 150 years, since John Tyndall at Cambridge University discovered that CO2 absorbs infrared radiation, the physics of this have not been particularly mysterious. They've been known. And less than a generation later, a Swedish scientist worked out pretty much the exact magnitude of how much heat increase would flow from how much CO2 increase. But in any case, look at Venus and Earth. The temperature on Earth is an average, on an annual basis, of 59 degrees Fahrenheit, 15 Celsius. Temperature on Venus is an average of 867 degrees Fahrenheit, 455 Celsius, above the melting point of lead, and it rains sulfuric acid. And trust me, no matter what the weather forecast is, you don't want that one. Now, that's relevant, and it's not that Venus is slightly closer to the Sun. Venus is three times hotter than Mercury, which is right next to the Sun. It's the CO2. And that tale of two planets is relevant to our current civilization-wide strategy of removing as much carbon from the ground as we can, as quickly as we can, and burning it in ways that transform the composition of CO2 into the atmosphere. For the last million, probably 35 million years, the CO2 levels have never been above 300 parts per million. The beginning of the Industrial Revolution, 280 parts per million. Just in the last 100 years, we have moved it from 280 to 383 this year. And the debate now is about whether it's possible to stop at 450 or 550, or whether it'll go, and already, even at 383, the latest studies just in the last few months have shown that the melting rate at the North Polar ice cap is apparently three times faster than the most pessimistic computer models had projected. It could be completely gone in summer when we need it to reflect the sun. It could be completely gone in as little as 35 years. And if it goes, it will not come back on any time scale that is relevant to the human species.
So that story is in this opinion about moving beyond Kyoto.
Yep.
Kyoto, the protocol that you negotiated, and then the administration, the Clinton administration, didn't take to a vote.
We didn't take it to a vote because try as hard as I could, I couldn't convince more than one out of 100 senators to agree to vote
so
to ratify.
So the U.S. is not a party to that.
Right.
And in this opinion, you say we've got to move beyond Kyoto.
Yeah.
What do you call for?
Well, I mean, I think that the new treaty, the current roadmap, chartered at the Earth Summit in Rio in 1992, the U.S. did sign and ratify a treaty that obligates us under international law to prevent the accumulation of dangerous levels of anthropogenic, human-caused CO2 greenhouse gas emissions. So we're obligated under international law to do that. The Kyoto Protocol is really an appendage to that treaty. Now, that same process calls for a follow-on treaty will be negotiated beginning in Bali this December, and it will be a tougher treaty with more severe provisions. And we have to find a way to do it. The two largest emitters worldwide, the United States and China, and soon China, if it hasn't already, China will become the largest emitter, but the U.S. and China, neither are part of Kyoto. Both must be a part of this new treaty. How we accomplish that remains for us to work out. It has to happen. We have to find a way to do it. And changing changing consciousness, changing political awareness, creating a political mass based upon the truth of our situation instead of illusions and self-interested delusions promoted by, in part, by multi-million dollar annual campaigns financed by some of the largest carbon polluters who want to continue treating the atmosphere as an open sewer. That is designed to prevent the achievement of this political critical mass. If we achieve it, then it will be possible to move to much more effective treaty provisions.
Al Gore, the former vice president, speaking last month at the Aspen Institute in Aspen, Colorado. This is Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. Now, back to that conversation moderated by venture capitalist John Doerr.
Let's turn to this latest book, The Assault on Reason, a New York Times bestseller. When I Googled this, I found 3.4 million results linking to it. A review that I read said, "Assault on Reason reveals an angry, impassioned Al Gore, a fiery throw caution to the winds Al Gore, who, whether he runs or not for the White House, has decided to lay it all on the line with a blistering assessment of the Bush administration, the state of public discourse in America at this fateful juncture in history."
And why not?
So let's go there. What was your goal with this book? What do you want us to take away from this?
Well, you know, this John and I have been participating in this great conference. Many of the people are here from it, but to those the much larger number who are not, we've had a really intensive set of discussions on how to solve the climate crisis, and so many people have returned over and over again in different ways to this point that at present, the maximum that's considered politically feasible worldwide still falls short of the minimum that will actually solve this crisis. So we have to find a way to expand the limits of what is politically possible. Now, reason-based policy is really the bedrock of what we think of as modern democratic governance. And if you go back and unwind where that came from, you know, 500 years ago, feudalism was the order of the day in Europe, and if you wanted to be a writer, you had to be a monk, and then you could copy a dead guy's book in a dead language. And 99% of the people had no civic knowledge. The printing press triggered a complete revolution in information dissemination and created a new information ecology that for the first time made it possible for individuals to use knowledge and reason as a source of influence and power. And within 10 years, there were 110 cities within 10 years of Gutenberg, there were 110 cities in Europe with printing presses that were active. I mean, the first OJ-style news was when Columbus returned from the Bahamas, and there were 11 print editions of his journey, and that triggered the voyages of discovery. Within 15 years, everything had been discovered. The world changed, and that led to the emergence of a new sovereign source of authority, the rule of reason. And the American Revolution really came out of the Enlightenment, which said, you know, what would a reasonable person conclude on the basis of the best evidence after a full chance to discuss we can find as the best available evidence that's more likely than not to be true. Now, the age of print ended about 40 years ago when this incredibly powerful new technology, television, which synthesized the framework of broadcasting, which had been demonstrated with radio, with the quasi-hypnotic pictures that we have a kind of a television receptor. The average American now watches television more than 4.5 hours a day. And unlike the print universe, it is a one-way flow of information. In any case, I ask myself the question, what does the climate crisis have in common with the invasion of Iraq? Answer, in both cases, the truth was pushed aside. The best evidence was not only ignored, but buried. And the decisions were made on the basis of preconceived ideological views that were shaped not by a search for truth or a dialogue based on reason, but on responses to raw power and raw political influence. And if we in the United States of America allow ourselves to drift ever farther away from a system of self-governance based on a shared search for what our best options are, what is the most reasonable set of choices that we can make to solve our problems, seize our opportunities, give our children a better chance in life. What made this nation great was our commitment to try to reason together and find evidence-based solutions to the best of our ability. And representative democracy in our Constitution was just, you know, a kind of software for empowering this massively parallel processing of information in our civic life together. And now all of a sudden, we have the recombining of wealth and power using information strategies in a kind of a propagandistic way to achieve certain results that would never be. I mean, look, when the Senate voted to invade Iraq, 77% of the American people actually believed that the person most responsible for flying the planes into the World Trade Center towers was Saddam Hussein. And if we have huge falsehoods, and false impressions that persist for an extended period of time as the basis for our policy choices, then no wonder we're driving over the edge of a cliff.
So So we see, and you've created another wave in media and in communication. It's the YouTubes. It's the current TVs. It's the internet. Now, forecast for us how that's going to change reason and civil discourse.
Okay, if you're Thomas Paine in the modern age, and you have a point of view that is labeled common sense, and you see a set of crazy realities out there that have to be changed, you know, you're not going to do a pamphlet. If you try to put that on television, it's not going to work. You can put it on the internet. You can publish a book, but the internet reestablishes the possibilities for a communications ecology with very low entry barriers for individuals and the possibility of a meritocracy of ideas where the perceived truthfulness, value, validity of an individual's expression or perception can be lifted up by lots of people who agree with that perception. See, that doesn't happen in television. It doesn't happen in radio. It can happen in the internet. The internet is a source of hope if we allow it, if we protect it against the very determined efforts for economic reasons to try to leverage monopolies over distribution into control over content dissemination. That's a battle in the Congress now. It's seen as an arcane issue. I think that as Americans, those of us who are Americans here, I think we should bring the same passionate commitment to keeping the internet free that our founders brought to the First Amendment to keep the freedom of the printing press.
Former Vice President Al Gore speaking July 18th in Aspen, Colorado. This is Word for Word from American Public Media.
To this climate conference that we've had, Hal Harvey set the stage for us with a challenge that we've got to design to win. We've got to have a framework. He said there's no silver bullet for this crisis, but he floored me in saying we've got to take 30 gigatons of CO2 out of the atmosphere by 2030 if we want just a 50-50 chance of averting climate crisis. Yeah. My question to you about this is, aren't we already cooked? Isn't this cake baked?
No.
We take a hard, honest look at these numbers, and if we're already cooked, why should we bother?
My friend Bill McKibben, I think was the first one I heard say, we don't have a silver bullet, we have silver buckshot. And we do have lots of buckshot which add up to viable solutions to this crisis. We are not already cooked. The same scientists who have warned that we may have as little as 10 years to begin making major changes also say that it is not too late. But it is a race. It is a race. And I just wish that I could find a way to convey not only from my head to yours, but from the feelings I have to yours, that what I so passionately believe is the appropriate sense of urgency. We all have to be a part of this. If there is not a fundamental sea change, it won't really matter who is in elective office. We have to have a sea change at the grassroots level. There is still time to do that. There is time to do that. You know, we had one of the participants in this conference. She's a store manager for Walmart, and she was talking about the transformation that she went through just in the last couple of years and connecting to her children's perception of what the world is going to be like. And not many years from now, certainly not many decades from now, our children and grandchildren will, I promise you, they will ask one of two questions. either in looking back on 2007, in the beginning of this century, either they will ask, what in God's name were they thinking? Didn't they see the scientific evidence? Didn't they hear the scientists practically shouting from the rooftops? Didn't they notice the ice melting? Didn't they notice all of the radical ecological changes? Look at the bark beetles in this not far from here. There are thousands of examples, thousands. Either they will ask, why in God's name didn't they do something? Didn't they care about us? Were they too distracted? Were they too greedy? Were they too unconscious? What in the world were they thinking? Or they will ask a second question, the one I prefer them to ask. How did they find the uncommon moral courage to rise to successfully meet a challenge that so many said was impossible to solve? That is our challenge now. We have to do it. Let me say one other thing. I want to circle back to a question you asked before that I didn't answer. The World War II generation, we call the greatest generation. They won the battle against fascism in Europe and in the Pacific simultaneously, but then when they came home, they found that they had acquired a new capacity for long-term vision and moral authority that they didn't possess when they left as 19, 20, 21-year-olds. And when Omar Bradley said, it's time that we steered by the stars and not by the lights of every passing ship, they said, yeah, a Marshall Plan, raise taxes for it, you bet. We're tired of Europe exporting world wars. Establish the United Nations, these global institutions, you bet. Let's look out 50 years, and let's build a world for our children and grandchildren that doesn't require us to leave our homes and farms twice in a century to go over and fight these bloody wars. And it was that moral authority and commitment that led them to address these. It came out of rising to meet the crisis of global fascism. This climate crisis is not only what we have to do, it is also our chance to get our act together. There are, if you haven't noticed, and I know you have, a lot of Darfur, tens of millions of children dying completely unnecessarily every year for lack of penicillin or clean water. The destruction of the ocean fisheries at a shocking rate. The loss of tropical forest at the rate of one football field every second. The great extinction event that is now unfolding on this planet. These are not political problems. They are moral imperatives. And our ability to perceive them as moral imperatives and to see them for what they really are depends upon our ability as a generation of human beings alive right now to rise and meet this climate crisis and in the doing of that, gain our moral authority and long-term vision to get our act together globally and start doing the right thing.
Al.
John.
Are there any presidential candidates today with a bold vision to address this problem?
The relationship between political leader and populace is a symbiotic relationship. We have this image of a single leader being elected and then bringing about unilaterally, single-handedly, a transformation. Franklin Roosevelt did that. George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, etc. What we have in the world today is a very different kind of challenge. I had an encompassing vision when I went into the White House, albeit as vice president, in 1993. I saw firsthand what it is like to try to convince a Congress of men and women who, by and large, wanted to do the right thing, but were in this symbiotic relationship and had limits to what they felt they had permission to even consider. When I impose things like a carbon tax or the mileage standards and, you know, radical change in this area and that area. What the traffic will bear politically depends upon what is in the minds and hearts of the people. And that is true in this country, it's true in China, it's true in India, it's true in South America, in Europe, in Africa. I'm starting a training program this fall in India, and in the five most common languages in India. Starting a training program in China. Starting next month, we're doing one for Spanish-speaking peoples in Spain, but focused as well on Latin America. We have one in Johannesburg next year, and finding ways to cover the continent. I am engaged in a different kind of campaign to try to do as much as I can with as much help as I can gather to try to bring about a change in thinking and awareness and consciousness worldwide. This is not just a problem for a political leader who is obligated to deal with 1,000 different issues every single day. This is a challenge that faces our entire world. I do understand that there is no position that approaches that of president in terms of its ability to influence the course of events. But I also understand from firsthand experience that the limits of change have to be addressed. And I myself believe that perhaps the highest and best use of the experience and whatever talents that I have gained is to try to bring about that sea change in thinking among the people themselves.
So we'll come back to that, but let's talk about today's presidential candidates.
No, I don't see any, I don't see or hear any sustained vision that assigns the appropriate scale or sense of urgency that this requires.
What is the minimum position that every candidate should have on climate change going into this election, the minimum without which, below which, we shouldn't even think about voting for them?
I would like every single one of the candidates in both parties to sign up to the 7-point Live Earth Pledge.
And those points are?
To demand the completion of a treaty within 2 years that reduces CO2 by 90% in developed countries and more than half worldwide in time for the next generation to inherit a healthy Earth. To protect and preserve forests. To bring about new laws and policies promoting renewable energy as a substitute for dependence on oil and coal. To have a moratorium on the construction of any new coal-fired power plant that does not have carbon capture and sequestration capacity so that it can be installed or retrofitted to become carbon neutral. And I think that nobody in the political system is saying this because it is seen still as political anathema. It's seen as outside the scope of what is politically permissible. What I want to do is to change the limits of what's possible and what's permissible. You know, there's an old African proverb that says, if you want to go quickly, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. We have to go far quickly. And building a consensus that is beyond political, that is nonpartisan, bipartisan, is an urgent task. This really should not be a political issue. In the United Kingdom, it's a political issue only in the sense that both of the major parties are totally committed to solving it, and they compete on the basis of how far and how bold they can be and how far they can go. And that's what we ought to have here in the United States.
So energy policy is a hot topic in Congress right now. We've seen a bill pass the Senate. There's one that's going to be introduced in the House. What do you think of what's going on in Washington, D.C.?
Well, as I said to you earlier, I must offer a disclaimer. I have recently begun to fear that I'm losing my objectivity on the Bush-Cheney administration, so you should take my thoughts with a grain of salt. You know, I think that Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi are trying valiantly to do a terrific job. I really do. And I think that there are some provisions of the pending legislation that would be extremely useful to have. And I think that, you know, Tom Friedman's the only columnist in America, really, who has written about what's going on with this crisis and with the energy bill. And thank you, Tom. It is a disgrace to just, and not that some of the provisions aren't good, they are, but we're basically just piddling around and just nibbling around the edges of this. And I mean, I know from personal experience how vulnerable politicians are to passing some minor little thing and then in a kind of a shared effort promoted as the, you know, the be-all and end-all. And what worries me about the pending legislation, in spite of the fact that there are some good provisions that should be passed, we should not have illusions about what it really is. These are little baby steps, little baby steps. And they're useful to take, but we shouldn't be confused. We shouldn't confuse them with actually what's going to be needed to solve this.
So what do you advocate? How about cap and trade, whatever that is? How about carbon tax? What legislation would Al Gore move through Washington, D.C.?
Cap and trade, for those who are not familiar with the term, is what the Kyoto Treaty provides. The mechanism actually was one that George H.W. Bush, the first President Bush, deserves credit for passing to deal with sulfur dioxide emissions, a more conventional source of pollution that is in dirty air. And I was one of the Democrats in the Senate who supported it. And basically what it says, let's put a cap. They sort of froze the level of CO2 and allocated the right to continue and then allowed trading of emissions rights on the theory that the economy would find the most efficient way to allocate each marginal dollar to get the steepest reduction. And what happened is there were radical reductions at a tiny fraction of the cost projected by the pessimists.
So will that do the job?
It can help tremendously, and we should have a global treaty. The United States should lead the way instead of trying to block this, to have a global cap and trade system for CO2. I also strongly favor what many regard as a radical measure, but I've long proposed, for 15 years, I have called for the elimination of the payroll tax and the replacement of that revenue dollar for dollar with a CO2 tax to put a price on carbon so that we start making sensible decisions about it. See, right now, we're in a bubble of illusion that the Earth's atmosphere is an open sewer and that it's okay to dump 70 million tons of CO2 pollution into it every day. That's what we're doing. Tomorrow will be a little more and the day after a little more. If we had to find a way to put a price on it, then we'll drive reductions. Both cap and trade and a CO2 tax would both do that. I think we need both.
I read with some alarm in the last couple of weeks a report that said, well ahead of anybody's forecast, China is now emitting more CO2 than the U.S. Yeah. And you're headed there in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Tell us about China. Tell us about CO2. If we do everything we can in the United States, is it going to make any difference?
I'll be spending a week or 10 days there soon. Again, I've been there a lot, given my slideshow there a lot, spent a lot of time with their leaders and scientists. The study that said China's already surpassed the U.S. is a little bit controversial, but it's also kind of a moot point because if they haven't already, they will within the next 6 to 12 months. And both the U.S. and China are neck and neck as the two largest sources of CO2 pollution. We both have lots of coal, and we both have to find ways to change this. China does have an impressive demonstrated commitment to make big changes on a massive scale. There is no reason why China's continued economic development has to be accompanied by the same levels of pollution that accompanied the early stages of the Industrial Revolution in the West. There are new technologies. We should help to make them more readily available. The key change, though, John, is we have to catalyze the emergence of a global awareness of who we are as human beings and the danger that we're now facing. Just as the time came in the Italian peninsula when it was no longer the case that cities attacked, went to war with one another, what they had in common was more important, just as in Europe it's now absurd to think that France is going to invade Germany or Germany is going to invade France, that what they have in common is more important, we have to achieve that breakthrough in consciousness worldwide, because the truth is this is a global threat, and more CO2 anywhere is a threat to people everywhere. Reductions anywhere benefit us. If we can help China reduce, if we can help Brazil avoid deforestation, if we can help Indonesia reduce CO2, that is directly beneficial to us. Thank you all.
Former Vice President Al Gore, an advocate for reducing carbon dioxide emissions, he is also author of the book, The Assault on Reason. His conversation July 18th in Aspen, Colorado, was sponsored by the Aspen Institute and the venture capitalist firm Kleiner Perkins Caulfield & Byers, whose partner John Doerr served as the moderator. If you missed part of today's speech by Al Gore, or if you would just like to hear it again, the place to go is our website, wordforword.org. In addition to hearing this week's show, you may also subscribe to our free weekly podcast and listen to any of our previous programs, including one with Senator John Kerry and former House Speaker Newt Gingrich debating whether government or the private sector held the best answers to reducing the greenhouse effect. You may also hear other speeches on Iraq, our food chain, and the care we get from doctors, all of that in our archives. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word. For American Public Media, I'm Melinda Pencava. Word for Word is produced by Curtis Gilbert and Marissa Anderson, with associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph, and the technical director is Sam Keenan. Special thanks this week to Kirk Sigler and Aspen Public Radio. American Public Media.